Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Government statistics suggest that 1 in 10 Americans is struggling with addiction. The CDC estimates that excessive alcohol use cost almost $250 billion in 2010, and opioid overdoses last year overtook car accidents as the leading cause of accidental deaths in the U.S. Our understanding of how addiction plays out in the brain has increased dramatically in recent years, but that hasn't translated into treatment options. Judy Grizel is in a unique position to appreciate both the challenges and the stakes involved in addiction research. She's a neuroscientist and professor of psychology at Bucknell University, but in her early 20s, she was a college dropout and daily drug user. Her new book, Never Enough, The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction, is equal parts textbook and memoir. Judy, welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. Thank you.
Your book opens with a pretty harrowing account of your descent into addiction, starting with the first time that you got drunk as a 13-year-old. 30 years later, do you have, at this point, an understanding of what happened and why you, of all of your peers who maybe drank in high school, ended up in such a dire state by your early 20s?
Well, I have a much better understanding than I did certainly when I hit bottom. And I guess my understanding gets better and better every year, but it is still difficult to predict exactly who's going to develop a problem and who's not. I think there are lots of biological risk factors and lots of environmental risk factors, and I just seem to be one of those 1 in 10, as you say, that had an unlucky hand, I guess.
And you say when you hit bottom, what was the bottom for you?
Well, it was kind of a long, drawn-out, unfolding disaster, but I'd say the lowest point for me was after I had stopped injecting cocaine because of a terrible near-death and lots of legal problems experience. And as a result, though, of not using cocaine so avidly, I was able to scrape together some money with some friends and get an apartment.
And we should say you'd been homeless for a period.
I'd been homeless for a while, yeah, kind of on and off, but most of, 2 or 3 years. And anyway, with the apartment, I had a mirror. And one day, I don't know if you've ever had this experience where you kind of look right into yourself and it looks like, who is that stranger staring back at me? Mm-hmm. So I had that look, but instead of seeing kind of a friendly or benign stranger, I saw a very lost self, and so lost that I didn't even recognize myself. And I felt kind of in the pit of my stomach just an absolute sinking feeling of self-loathing for sure, but also kind of despair. And I think that even though for about 10 years I'd been arranging my life just the way I liked it and using all I could pretty much all the time, that despair was hard to ignore. And I spent about another 3 months trying to tamp it down with as much chemical as I could get in me, but I was unsuccessful at that. So I kind of had a moment of reckoning, I guess.
You describe yourself as, for those years, pretty much using any drug you could get your hands on, as much as you could get your hands on. And in order to make that possible, winnowing down friends, and even for that matter, becoming estranged from your family, winnowing away anyone who would not support your behavior. And yet you say it was a visit with your father that helped turn you around. What happened?
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess that we are social creatures, and it must have, deep down under all the chemicals, I must have been missing those connections. Because when my father surprisingly offered to take me out to dinner on my 23rd birthday, and we hadn't spoken really in a few years. In fact, the way I remember it is, if people would ask him if he had any kids, he would say he had 2 sons. He wouldn't even kind of allude to me. I think it was so painful. So, yeah. And I sort of understood. We were definitely estranged. But for some reason, he decided to take me out, and I was very much braced for the interaction. I was full of self-righteousness. It's kind of hard to believe now, but I wasn't at all open to warmth. I guess I thought he sort of owed me a dinner, really. And and he surprised us both. In fact, he doesn't remember this, and no one in my family, my brothers and I all kind of think about it like, how did this happen? But he said, you know, I really just want you to be happy, which I think is his core hope for me, but it never was able to express itself under all the other directions and critiques and criticism, you know, everything else. So when he said that, because I had had that image of myself in the mirror that I was unable to blot out, I just sort of fell apart, and I sure didn't expect that, and I didn't know what the outcome would be, and I don't think he did too much either. But my dear mother, who'd been researching treatment centers since I was about 15, was ready in the wings. Mm. She wasn't at the dinner, but she had a plan, and they together took me to treatment. And I said, this was in the late 80s, so it's hilarious to me now, but I had never heard of a treatment center, and I thought it might be like a spa, you know, where I would get, you know, extra treatment. When I saw the nurses, I was kind of backing out the door, but I was in the middle of nowhere, so I decided to stick it out, and that really was the beginning of my transformation.
And at some point in that transformation, the idea occurs to you that there might be a cure for addiction, and you might be the one who could find it. And that set you on a path eventually to college and graduate school. I mean, that's really a remarkable turnaround. Where do you think that idea came from?
Well, I think that idea would come pretty much to any addict who was cornered like I felt. My whole life was about using. And even though I ended up in treatment, I wasn't really intending to live the rest of my life without mind-altering chemicals. So I figured I could understand it better and somehow game things. So when I heard in treatment that people thought I had a disease and that I might not be able to use without self-destructing, I think my mind, typical of most people like me, thought there's got to be a back door. There's got to be another way. You know, I had gotten through lots of tricky situations, and this was definitely one of those. And I thought, okay, I got a disease, I'll fix it. Which, you know, you alluded to this earlier, but I had been kicked out of 3 schools by this time. If I had a GPA, you know, it was full of F's and D's and a few A's if I was really interested, but I don't think it was 2.0. So why I thought that I could do this was more a testament to my determination to use than it was to anything, you know, admirable.
Judy Grizel, you write that you chose to become a neuroscientist specifically because the prevailing view at that point was pretty much that, as you've mentioned, addiction was a disease of the brain and that our brain kind of determines who we are and what our life looks like. And instead, you say now the prevailing view and your view is not so much that the brain is the determiner, but that the brain is the stage on which our life plays out. What do you mean by that?
I, as a neuroscientist, along with all of the rest of us, I think we believe that, and we know that everything we experience has a neural correlate. That means that the electrical and chemical signals in the brain are correlated with all that we think and feel and do. So that's clear, including our addictive behaviors. What we used to think was that the brain was causing all those things kind of on its own as some master, you know, Oz behind the curtain. But now we really understand how our brain is a function of our environments and our experiences and our social interactions and our even our gut microbiome, our immune system. So we've widened our perspective quite a lot.
I mean, this is the idea of plasticity, right? That our brain does influence our perceptions and our actions and our thoughts, but then everything that we experience feeds back and actually changes our brain.
Yeah, it has a lot to do with plasticity. And I guess what everybody appreciates probably by now is that the brain influences and contributes to our behaviors, let's say, in our thoughts and our feelings. But it's also the other way around, that our behaviors, thoughts, and feelings influence the structure and function of our brain. So it's really a bidirectional relationship.
And you write about one particular aspect of this back and forth between the brain and our environment or our experiences that centers around something that has actually become, I think, kind of a common idea, that we kind of have a happiness set point, that we're all kind of trying to maintain this kind of even keel. And you write that the brain actually does this in what seem to me like just bizarre and astounding ways. It's like an equal and opposite reaction. For every happy thing that we experience, our brain like manufactures a negative to bring us back to that initial set point.
Yes, that's right, Heather. There's kind of a lot to that. Probably 50 years ago, psychologists recognized that people who are kind of happy kids tend to be happy adults, and sad kids, you know, tend to be sad adults. This is sort of a persistent facet of our personality, just our baseline mood. And we've also noticed that if something terrific happens or something terrible happens, there's a little blip in that mood, but it's temporary. And we sort of go right back to where we were, almost no matter what happens. So that's been appreciated for a while. But the way that we understand it now is that stable state is due to the brain's ability to counteract any kind of perturbation that causes happiness or sadness. And the reason for that, you could probably imagine, is that if we were just bouncing around from elated to despairing all of the time, it would be really hard to tell if something important was happening. So if we need to pay attention to some really good news or to some really bad event that happens, but we didn't have a stable baseline, it'd be hard to tell. And the brain is all about trying to decide if something is happening, something important is happening. So in order to note important events, this stable baseline or this stable neutral state has to be maintained. And for drug users, that's so tough because we take the drugs because we want to feel better and elated and euphoric. But the brain can and will, in every case, counteract that.
Which means that over time, you no longer get that euphoric feeling, and that leads to using more in search of that, right?
That's right. You can notice it in a single session, or you can notice it across time. So in a single session, after using cocaine or after drinking coffee even, you feel dysphoric or a little tired. So it's always there, but the brain is not only good at adapting, it's good at predicting this change. It's good at learning. So as you talked about the plasticity before, the brain recognizes patterns in our behavior. And if I'm a regular cocaine user and my brain knows it's coming, or a regular caffeine user, then the brain counteracts the effects of the drug kind of in preparation for the drug delivery. And that means that when I don't have the drug, I feel worse than normal. My baseline or my neutral state is low. And when I get the drug, I feel just right. So then I'm dependent.
Judy Grizel, having both lived and studied addiction, you're probably in the perfect position to try to define it. And you have one of the clearest delineations of what constitutes addiction in terms of the specific brain pathways that must be affected, and kind of what the difference is and what maybe the line is between dependence and addiction, because those two can be different, right?
Yes. So dependence is evident when you take away the drug and you feel less than normal. So I'm dependent for sure on caffeine, but
as are a lot of us.
Yes. Makes the world better, doesn't it? But if we take it away, if I take it away, I miss it. But it doesn't cause me any damage. In fact, there's some evidence that it's actually good for us. So it's not hurting other people. It's not hurting my relationships or my livelihood. And so for that reason, I don't have an addiction. So I think addiction has to have not only the dependence, but the craving and the obsession, spending time and money to get the drug at the cost of other good aspects of my life. So it's compromising my well-being rather than helping it.
Judy Grizel, 30 years sober, 25 years a neuroscience researcher studying addiction. Do you still think a cure is possible? And what do you think it might look like?
Yeah, Because I see addiction as a kind of a vulnerability to lots of factors in the environment, I think that, so a biologic vulnerability to those factors, I think that addressing both the biological influences and the environmental influences will be necessary to really help people. And I don't know, I think a cure is maybe unlikely. Others might disagree with me, so I think this is an empirical question, which is one great thing about science. If there's a cure, you know, we should keep working for it. But if there's not, there's certainly many things that we can do on the way to try to help. And I think that the research itself is pointing to a lot of those things.
Like what?
So it turns out, you know, just to be really quick about it, I thought it was going to be a simple problem in the brain. I'd flip the switch and be able to drink champagne or something. And it's not that simple. It's very much more complex. But that gives us lots of opportunities for intervening.
Judy Grizel is a professor of psychology at Bucknell University, and author of Never Enough, The Neuroscience and Experience of Addiction. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.